Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Alan Chaui, immediate past president of the Massachusetts Medical Society, who conducted a study along with the Harvard School of Public Health determining that physician and clinician burnout is so prevalent in this country it should be considered a national emergency and what needs to be done. Lori Robertson also checks in, managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Alan Chaui here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Alan Chaui, immediate past president of the Massachusetts Medical Society and co-author of a new report on the healthcare crisis of physician burnout in American healthcare. Dr. Chaui is a primary care physician in private practice in Peabody, Massachusetts. He holds a teaching position at Tufts, Boston University, and Boston College School of Nursing. Dr. Chaui received his medical degree from Aim Shams University in Egypt. He completed his residency at Akron City Hospital and St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, Ohio. Dr. Chaui, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much, Mark. Thank you, Margaret.
You've been collaborating with a number of organizations when you were in the leadership position at the Massachusetts Medical Society, really focusing specifically on the nation's doctors. And I'm wondering if you could help our listeners understand the scope of clinician burnout and how it's affecting public health.
Essentially, in May 2018, at our annual meeting of the MMS, I was speaking with Dean Michelle Williams of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health that physician burnout was a major problem impacting physicians, our patients, and in fact, the whole healthcare system, and it did require immediate attention. And she did her homework, and after some preliminary research herself, she agreed that physician burnout is an important issue and needed attention. She then asked Dr. Ashish Jha, the director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. He's also a practicing general internist. And I went ahead and spoke with Ashish, who immediately understood the magnitude of the issue. And then he began to work with us on the report. And then, as you know, a bunch of studies from Mayo quoted that the burnout rate is up to 54%. Which is one out of two doctors suffer from symptoms of burnout. And some other studies showed numbers that are up to 74% of physicians have shown at least one symptom of the burnout over time. Some of these symptoms, Mark, are like emotional exhaustion, depersonalization, low sense of personal accomplishment. There's also a recent study which is on the Medscape report from 2019. Actually, this study is entitled Medscape National Physician Burnout, Depression, and Suicide Report 2019. It's really full of data. You know, I'm on the front line. I'm a family physician in, in private practice. My neighbor across the hall, who essentially retired from his practice in gastroenterology, he was a solo practitioner who had an excellent reputation, and his patients loved him. He actually retired at age 60, and that's the trend now. Physicians are used to retire in their 70s. Now they're retiring at as early as 60s and 50s, and that's really saddening. So with one out of two physicians experiencing some level of burnout symptoms and seeing that the health system is not responding to these needed changes and seeing the physician shortage expected down the pike, and this amount of retirement, that really pointed to a public health crisis because it's definitely affecting our patients.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Chawi, you've noted that, in fact, clinician burnout, and I'll use the term clinician more broadly here, though I know your focus is on physicians, is not a new phenomenon, but the pace of burnout has accelerated significantly over the past decades. And I can, you know, think about some of the major changes that might be contributing that aren't always looked at, the change in people being self-employed versus employed by others, loss of control, the shift from people going to the hospital in the morning and the practice in the afternoon and having all that other social engagement, largely transformed by hospitalists managing the hospital and everybody else in the practice. But the things that we hear most often about relative to burnout are seem to be things that we ought to have been able to fix. The electronic health record impact, EHR fatigue, the reporting demands, the amount of documentation that needs to be done, really in the name of quality of care, but as somebody is doing the 1,000 clicks per visit, they wonder sometimes how much this has to do with quality versus how much it has to do with payment. Talk with us a little bit about how those very tangible things like the EHR fatigue or reporting demands are contributing to the problem. And you've talked about an early exit from the profession as one of the most profound potential adverse consequences. Are there others that you are seeing as well?
You know, Margaret, I will also note that there are other reasons, and thus we encourage each healthcare system to survey their physicians to learn what are these drivers that are causing burnout. You know, EMR is just one of them. So with that said, as you pointed out, the EHR is a leading cause of burnout. As you know, the demand for a prior authorization. In the past, prior authorizations were made to control cost, and we used to do prior authorization for high-cost radiology. Now, prior authorizations are for everything. That, as well as the quality reporting. Quality reporting and documentation that take away from our patient time. Because, you know, the patients is the reason why we went into medicine. And that's the very intimate space between the patient-physician that has been intruded by all these non-patient-related functions, and it hurts the patient-physician relationship and does reduce the clinician satisfaction with their work. Not one physician complained about having to see too many patients. What is demoralizing is the fact that I have to do a lot of unnecessary and time-consuming work that has nothing to do with patient care. The EHR was supposed to enhance the physician-patient experience, but the truth is the EHR is not user-friendly. There was a recent article, Death by a 1,000 Clicks. EHR has added 2 hours of data by physicians for every 1 hour of patient time. We also call it pajama time. The physicians are actually working for the EHR. Another point you mentioned is the prior authorization. It takes an additional 15 hours per week per physician. So all the cumulative effect on the physician community, as the literature has clearly shown, is clinicians are choosing to retire early or change to part-time, or they decided to continue to work and be dissatisfied, and that's not sustainable.
You know, I want to first note that we had the opportunity of having Dr. Don Rucker on, who is the National Coordinator for Health IT. He says help's on the way, Margaret.
Yeah.
Really talking about how they advance API-enabled solutions and the like. But I did want to pick up on your point that physicians are doing things that have nothing to do with patient care. But, you know, if I look back 1983, 75% or more of the practices were owned by physicians, private practices owned by physicians. And if you look now, it's less than half. I'm wondering if they've moved from employers to employees and it's finally manifesting itself. They've lost control of their practice.
Yeah.
How does that figure in to the analysis, but they are certainly no longer the folks who call the shots in their practice. So they're having to do things that are much different because they're employees.
Exactly. And the loss of autonomy is actually one of the main reasons of physician burnout. So your question, actually, you have multiple parts to your question. And I will say, Mark, that the EHRs are here to stay. I mean, I actually like the idea of EHR. It's a lot safer for our patients. But the companies that make them have little or no incentive to work together to make them interoperable. The EHRs were originally created as a billing tool, more than patient care. And we would like to move it to a more user-friendly tool that will actually help physicians deliver great care and communicate with each other for the care of their patients. So one of the promising solutions to make EHR more user-friendly would permit software developers to actually develop some apps that can operate with those certified EHR systems. Basically, what you mentioned, the word API, which is Application Programming Interface, which allows two different computer programs to talk to one another. In healthcare, we are having this problem with lack of interoperability, and that's not good for the patient, that's not good for the system, that's not good for the healthcare as a whole, because it is unhealthy for the patient to receive radiation twice and IV twice or labs twice, and it's more expensive to duplicate the work. So that's why, in short, those APIs allow those two computers to speak with one another. You know, you mentioned also about physicians being employed. Some of the studies showed that burnout is a lot less in private practice physicians because they do have some control over their schedules, control over how many patients they can see per hour, some control on ways they can address their patient care. For example, in my office, I work as a team, so when I take care of my patients, I feel like my whole staff work at the top of their license, and they actually help me take care of the patients, and the patients are actually more satisfied, and I am more satisfied with my care.
Well, Dr. Chaui, I'm so glad you ended on that note because it's exactly what I was thinking about. I want to talk about treating the symptoms of burnout in a minute, but on the treating the cause end, I think you've highlighted something really important with team-based care, which doesn't happen automatically. You know, it's a training unto itself. I was thinking also, Mark, about replacing prior authorizations with e-consults, mm-hmm. right, rather than filling out a lot of paperwork just to make something happen, like get the expert opinion that you need. Other people use scribes. I would add to that list having behavioral health people on your team. But then there's certainly been a proliferation of wellness programs being used in many high-stress industries with varying degrees of success. But I think it was Dr. Jaff from the Harvard School of Public Health pointed out, we're not going to fix this problem of physician burnout by doing more yoga. And yet, what evidence is there that wellness programs or programs that help to alleviate stress among physicians and all clinicians might actually play part of the role in helping us move forward in addressing this very real concern?
So, Margaret, I want to tell you about a gentleman that I got to meet at the Massachusetts Medical Society who came in and gave us a talk about how to deal with this situation. Dr. Tate Schoenfeld has been working on this issue for about 20 years. He's the chief wellness officer at Stanford. And Tate taught us that the key leadership behavior to help reduce burnout are to inform, inquire, and develop and recognize the problem. And according to him, leaders need to keep their staff informed. They need to ask for their suggestions and how to improve their work unit and facilitate their career development and recognize a job well done. The reason we say we don't need more yoga, Margaret, is that we know physicians and medical students are more resilient and less depressed than the general public when they start their careers. But there is something in the industry that's burning us out at an alarming rate, and that's a systemic issue. And honestly, all the yoga in the world will not fix it. Once somebody is deeply burned out, they really don't have the bandwidth to even participate in wellness programs. One of my co-chairs at the Physician Burnout Task Force, Dr. Steve Defosse, he and I are big proponents to what is known as an organizational culture of health. That is health for all the employees. and the customers, the patients, the communities, the environment. So we also strongly believe that there is a return on investment for organization which invests in a culture of health. You know, when we think of health, we're really thinking of all five dimensions of health, which is, you know, your emotional health, physical, mental, your quality of life, and reaching to one's full potential. So an effective chief wellness officer in conjunction with a thoughtful wellness program should be able to help individuals throughout the organization to improve in all five dimensions of health.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking today with Dr. Alan Chaui, immediate past president of the Massachusetts Medical Society and co-author of a new report on the health crisis of physician burnout in American healthcare. You know, Dr. Chaui, I really want to have you talk to our listeners about why this is a health crisis for our patients. You know, the average citizen in America makes around $45,000 a year, and Forbes magazine says that the highest paid job in America are physicians, around $200,000. And they may be listening to this and say, I suffer emotional exhaustion at my job and a sense of burnout. Why is this a national crisis that an average citizen should be concerned about?
Mark, this is a very good question. When we talk about money, money starts with, you know, going to school for to become a physician. And when physicians graduate from med school, they graduate with a ton of debt. The average is about $250,000 of debt before they even start their career. The art and science of medicine is the quintessential calling which historically allowed physicians to have a high degree of autonomy, meaningful work, and a lifetime of practicing to become independent masters of their craft. There's evidence that loss of the autonomy drives burnout. And when this happens, our patients feel it, and our patients are affected, because when we talk about the sacred bond, the patient-physician relationship, whenever I am in the exam room, the patient knows when I'm not well. The consolidation of the medical system and the corresponding, you know, corporatization of medical practice, which is having the physicians lose their autonomy and have to become employed, that also increases physician burnout and also affects patients. You know, I feel that when we speak to the lack of autonomy, the decision-making and patient-physician relationship is impeded by all these influences and causes more burnout. So I feel that mountains of useless paperwork is typically perceived as meaningless, and it does not help our patients and it doesn't help our physicians. When they look at us, they feel that they are in the same team as us. They would love to spend more time with their physician. They would love to see their physicians looking at the patient, examining the patient, listening to the patient, instead of clicking, wasting a lot of their time on unnecessary trivia that someone else can do for them.
I know that as a professor of medicine, you spend a considerable amount of your time training the next generation of physicians, and I think PAs. You're on the faculty of the Boston College School of Nursing, so I know you're engaged with nurses and nurse practitioners probably as well. So you have a great perch on the new clinicians who are coming into our 21st century model of care. Is it fruitful to look a little bit across the generational divide? I think about our new clinicians coming into practice. Mostly they're not taking call. Huge difference in terms of what we used to see as a major cause of burnout, particularly for our clinicians who had young children. They're incredibly effective at advocating for flexible hours. They have a team that supports them that is trained to a far higher level than years ago in terms of the work that's been done with medical assistants, the role of RNs in primary care. They're pretty good at setting their boundaries. The vast majority of new people coming into practice are coming in as employees, and I think by choice. So you have an entire generation of people who really got caught up in enormous and sweeping and stressful changes, electronic health record, changes in practice ownership, changes in the hospital community relationship. Is there any research that's going on looking at, is this particularly severe and accentuated in the generations of incredible people who devoted their lives to a particular model and got caught up in all this change? And does it span the generational divides?
So I have such high respect to the new generation. I have been blessed to have been able to teach and work with medical students, NPs and PA students. And I believe this new generation is going to be the answer for fixing the healthcare system. They are very smart. Mm-hmm. They are very tech savvy.
Yep.
And they value a work-life balance, which is something that I would admit that when I was at the beginning of my career and until today, I mean, work
sure.
is very, very important to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I did get to miss a lot of my family's yeah. time and my kids' games. And, you know, do I regret that? Hard to say, because
sure.
I did enjoy every minute taking care of patients.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the reports will show that by 2025, we will have a shortage of 90,000 physicians, Margaret. That is a huge loss. And teaching medical students, NPs and PA students, is a very important part of my practice. And I believe by preparing the new generation of clinicians with tools to survive the current challenges, by teaching them how to work smarter and as a part of a team, they will be a lot more prepared to lead the change for a better healthcare for our patients and our country. Studies show that when the healthcare team allows each member of the team to function at the top of their license, not only burnout is cut in half,
mm-hmm.
but the quality of patient care is much improved. As a study done in early 2015 at the University of Colorado, a team-based care model that improves job satisfaction. So when our healthcare system places too much burden on clinicians, we should not be surprised that the results are suboptimal access, poor outcomes, and increased burnout. But with team-based care models increasing patient access, you will also have improved clinical quality, and you cut the burnout in half. Also, there are some studies that show that increasing the medical assistant to clinician ratio to 2.5 to 1 and expanding the roles of the medical assistant throughout the patient visit can help the practices achieve what we call the quadruple aim: improved patient health outcomes, enhance the patient experience, and then lowering the cost of care and the total medical expense. The fourth part is improve the work life of physicians and their team. So I encourage people to actually look at that study model, and that's one of the models that I adopted here in my office in Peabody. If I could end with this very important message, at the end of the report, there are six directives that we advocate for that I would love people to be able to read and understand. But for the sake of our patients and our healthcare system, we have to work together to fix the current system by fulfilling these directives as soon as possible. These will bring back the joy into the practice of medicine. They will improve the access and the quality of patients' care and significantly reduce the cost of care.
We have been speaking today with Dr. Alan Chaui, immediate past president of the Massachusetts Medical Society and co-author of a new report on the health crisis of physician burnout in American healthcare. You can access the report by going to massmed.org or can follow them on Twitter by going to @massmedical. Dr. Chaui, thank you so much for your commitment to the practice of medicine, for illuminating this very important issue, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Mark and Margaret, I want to thank you again for having me on.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Former Vice President Joe Biden recently changed his position on the Hyde Amendment, with his campaign saying he supported it, and within days, Biden, a Democratic Democratic presidential candidate, saying he had changed his stance. Biden said, quote, "If I believe health care is a right, as I do, I can no longer support an amendment that makes that right dependent on someone's zip code." What is the Hyde Amendment? The 1976 measure is a federal ban on the funding of abortion. It restricts federal funding of abortion to only cases of rape, incest, or endangerment to the mother's life. The Hyde Amendment was enacted by Congress 3 years after the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision. Since it restricts federal funding, it affects coverage of abortion under Medicaid, a federal-state program that primarily serves low-income individuals. That's what Biden means by saying the amendment affects people depending on their zip code. The Kaiser Family Foundation explains that the Hyde Amendment was passed as a rider to a Health and Human Services appropriation bill and has been renewed each year by Congress. The Affordable Care Act similarly included language to block federal subsidies used to buy private insurance on the marketplaces from being used for abortion services beyond the exceptions under the Hyde Amendment. Under Medicaid, some states do use their own funding to pay for abortion beyond those exceptions. According to the Guttmacher Institute, which researches reproductive health and abortion, 15 states have policies to cover all or most medically necessary abortions through Medicaid, though 10 of them provide that coverage due to a court order. 4 states provide funding in cases of fetal impairment, and 4 pay for abortions when there's a risk of long-term damage to a woman's physical health. The Kaiser Family Foundation estimates that 14.5 million women of reproductive age are enrolled in Medicaid. The Hyde Amendment also affects other federal programs, including the Indian Health Service, the Children's Health Insurance Program, and Medicare. The Medicare for All legislation proposed by Senator Bernie Sanders calls for repealing the Hyde Amendment. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Vaccinations are considered one of the great public health achievements of the 20th century, reducing fatalities from most common and fatal diseases by up to 99%. As recently as 2009, only 45% of the nation's preschool-age children had received all of their recommended vaccinations and boosters. And researchers at the Children's Outcome Research Program at Children's Hospital in Colorado decided to take an in-depth look at the problem.
Primary care practitioners are so overstretched that it's rather impractical. And they also require a level of technical expertise that sometimes they don't have.
Dr. Allison Kemp conducted a study on what would help to generate better compliance with the required vaccinations. And she found that when parents received timely reminders from their state and local health departments, parents were much more likely to get the vaccinations and boosters for their children that they needed.
What our study did was to centralize those efforts. So it didn't take away from the primary care providers, but it helped them to do the reminder recall for their practices centrally using a state registry.
Dr. Kemp says her research shows that when a reminder message can be generated for an entire population across communities, it takes the onus and the burden off of the primary care and pediatric practices.
In a fairly short 6-month period, about 19% of children who were not up to date became up to date, versus about 13% in the practice-based recall state. So, which on a population level within 6 months is really very powerful.
And the study also suggests that there's a cost savings with a centralized state or county-run database and reminder system.
I can tell you that there have been some studies in recent years showing outbreaks related to a lack of immunization or delayed immunization, particularly pertussis, measles, and even H influenza. One case of influenza Haemophilus meningitis can cost tens of thousands of dollars. The costs of not preventing these illnesses are very high.
A state health department-driven vaccination program that assists private practices in vaccine compliance for their patient population, improving vaccination rates of young and vulnerable children. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.